actions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
Today we'll discuss China's currency manipulation with Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul, National Police Week with AFGE Local 2281 Second Vice President Barbara Heckman-Sauer, and the Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund's 25th anniversary with Director of Field Operations Robin Kehoe. Up with us now is Scott Paul. Welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you.
Scott, this week a delegation of Chinese and U.S. government officials met to discuss economic, trade, and military policies. How did that go?
Well, the Chinese made promises that they've made continuously over the last couple of years that they would begin to honor various commitments they've made on currency, on opening their market, on protecting intellectual property, and a number of other issues that are important to the to American businesses and American workers. I don't think the talks moved the ball down the field that much. I think it was a reiteration of a lot of the same promises that have been made. And I'll be honest, it was a little disappointing to see. And I think the problems are growing worse and not better. And the longer it takes us to find solutions for them, the harder they're going to be to solve.
Why do you think that there has been such a standstill on this?
Well, it's a good question, and it's the right question to ask. I think part of it is that, you know, as a political strategy, China is trying to run out the clock, so to speak, and is trying to get past the next election without having to make any meaningful concessions. And it's hoping to do that because I think that the leaders in China think that President Obama will be much more likely to act before an election than after an election when the pressure is off, so to speak. I also think that, you know, one of the challenges we have is that some people are quite happy with business as usual in China. And some people think that, well, as long as American companies are profitable, it doesn't matter that we have an enormous trade deficit, that we've lost a lot of manufacturing to China, that they're stealing our intellectual property, that the currency is misaligned. I'm making money, so that's okay. And so it is and unfortunately, those types of people have way too much influence in public policy. It's the Wall Street crowd. And that's also one of the issues that we confront, is that workers and businesses who actually make things oftentimes get left out of the debate. And unfortunately, when it comes to China, a lot of times that's also the case.
Scott, how long can companies expect to remain profitable if these elements are in play with China?
Well, I see a big challenge for American manufacturing moving forward because we have already lost so much productive capacity that regaining it is not an easy thing to do. It's much easier to hold on to the jobs that you have than it is to try to build something from the ground up. And honestly, that's the position that we're in right now. I do think that there are a couple of different factors to consider when we look at this. First, China is becoming slightly less competitive. That works in our favor. Inflation is going up in China. Wages are going up. Prices are going up. So it's more expensive to make things in China. You're never going to have a wage level that approaches American wages. But for some products where labor costs don't amount to much in terms of the overall cost of the product, we can be quite competitive. And so there are some forces that are working in favor of American manufacturing. The other forces, as I mentioned, kind of this loss of productive capacity, the fact that businesses still want to outsource a lot, certainly works against us. But I think that you also asked the right question about profits. I don't know that more American businesses are going to get involved in this fight unless they see their profits being eroded. Because right now the voices who are stepping up are domestic manufacturers, are industrial unions, and are a lot of economists who see a real danger in the imbalance of this relationship to the American economy. And I'll also say this, you know, the American people want us to take action on China. I mean, they're ready to go. Democrats, Republicans, Independents, they're ready for us to go. All they need really is a leader in a lot of ways.
Make the connection for the audience between China's currency manipulation and America's manufacturing industry.
Well, it's an important issue, and I'll just explain it like this. You know, in a perfect world, exchange rates are determined by the market. So when the U.S. economy is stronger, the dollar is stronger, which is good. If you're headed overseas on a trip, it means that your hotel is slightly less expensive, your airfare might be slightly less expensive, your food in France or in Japan or wherever might be slightly less expensive. But if you're trying to sell a good abroad, a strong dollar actually makes your good more expensive. And that's not a great thing. When it comes to China, you don't have any sort of market forces that are involved with determining the exchange rate. It's determined by the central bank in China. And it is kept artificially low. The Chinese currency is called the yuan. And they keep the value of the currency artificially low. That makes Chinese goods cheaper. It makes American goods relatively more expensive when we're trying to export them into the market into China. And it's caused an enormous trade deficit. And I think that there are a number of economists, everyone from Paul Krugman, who's very liberal, to the Institute for International Economics, very mainstream free trade think tank, think this is a problem because it does create this enormous trade deficit. We had $275 billion trade deficit last year with China. That means that we imported $275 billion more in Chinese products than we exported to China. At the end of the day, that means lost jobs, lost capacity, and it means we also owe money to China. It's one of the reasons why China is able to rack up all these trillions of dollars in foreign currency reserves.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul about China's currency manipulation. Scott, how long has this currency manipulation been going on?
Off and on for about a decade. China joined what's called the World Trade Organization in 2001 and theoretically opened up its markets to U.S. goods and vice versa. From 2001 to 2005, China kept a peg to the U.S. dollar. That means no matter how much our currency fluctuated against other currencies around the world, and it fluctuates every day, it stayed exactly the same in China. Now, there was a threat to slap sanctions on to Chinese products in 2005. The Senate passed legislation overwhelmingly. Actually, 67 senators voted for a bill. So China started to relax their peg of the currency. The value of their currency rose about 20% against the dollar. But then at the beginning of the recession, 2008, China re-pegged the currency. And it's had a very, very detrimental effect on American manufacturing. China agreed to revalue the currency again last June, again in the face of pressure. And so they did revalue the currency a little bit, but it's only moved up about 5% against the dollar. And most economists estimate that it's undervalued by 40%. And I'm throwing around a lot of figures here, and I apologize for that. But at the end of the day, it means that China's currency is still grossly undervalued. It means they get an unfair advantage in competing against American workers, American businesses. And they haven't made a significant move to change that, in part because of domestic pressure that they feel from their own industry. But it's something that the rest of the world is not very happy with China for doing.
Scott, it sounds like they joined the World Trade Organization, opened themselves up to the U.S., but said that we'll only do so under our rules and not according to the marketplace or any international agreements. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, China has said this is the way we're going to do it, we will ignore some of these rules. And if anyone wants to call us on it, sure, they can try to do that. And the real challenge, Jason, is that no one has called them on it. I mean, we went through the entire Bush administration without any adverse action with regard to China's economic policies. I mean, none. And so for 8 years, the Chinese thought that they could do what they were doing and there would be no consequences. Now, President Obama spoke very forcefully during the 2008 election about the need to change the equation with China. And I can certainly say that the rhetoric has grown stronger. In some cases, specific trade actions on Chinese products like steel and tires and clean energy products that are being heavily subsidized by the state, the administration has taken some action. But overall, when it comes to the currency manipulation or the intellectual property violations or the larger subsidies that Chinese industry gets, China's still doing it. We're letting them get away with it. And despite slightly harsher words, we're still pretty much at the status quo. I say, you know, shame on China for violating these obligations, but really, shame on us for letting China get away with it. I mean, that's where the real the blame lies, in my mind, is that, you know, you do need to be able to police the world trading system and to ensure that everyone's playing by the same set of rules, and we haven't done that.
Why haven't we done that? Why has this gone on for multiple administrations? Why isn't anyone calling China on this?
Right. Well, Jason, there's this idea of free trade, and it's taught to every American college student in economics 101, and it is a, you know, it's close to something that's considered a gospel by the leaders of both parties, and unfortunately, one of the notions about free trade that's incorrect is that you should never take corrective action if someone else is cheating on their trade obligations. It means that you're a protectionist. I mean, the reality is that China is not a free market. It's heavily subsidized by the state. You know, it's still a communist country. And it represents none of the qualities that free trade is supposed to embody. And we are, you know, so the elites of both parties have said, well, you know, we believe in free trade, so we don't believe in taking any action. The reality is that what China is practicing is not free trade. You know, it's quite the opposite. It's protecting its own industry at a very high cost for everyone else. And the idea that you shouldn't respond to that is just crazy. You know, again, I go back to Paul Krugman. You know, he's a Nobel Prize winning economist. He writes a column for the New York Times now. Professor at Princeton, won his Nobel Prize for free trade theory, and he's a free trader, and he's, you know, he's disagreed with a lot of positions that the labor movement has taken on trade issues, but on China, Paul Krugman says, we should just go ahead and slap tariffs on their products, and we won't start a trade war. In fact, China will correct its behavior, because no one's really ever asked China to correct its behavior before. And part of it is this philosophy, this free trade philosophy. And then part of it is that there are, you know, some entities in the United States, like Walmart, who have a lot to gain from cheap goods coming from China and who don't care where things are made. And so that's, I think those are the impediments that we have to making progress.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll continue with Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul on China's currency manipulation.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. Call the AFGE Benefits line at 1-888-844-2343 today to see how much you could save. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Scott Paul, Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, before the break, we were talking a lot about China, its trade and economic situations, and its currency manipulation. My question for you is China as powerful as people believe that it is?
You know, that's a really good question, and that's one of the myths that I would like to bust for your listeners. Does China have some leverage? Yeah, absolutely it does. I mean, China has about, you know, over $1 trillion of treasuries. But when you look at the big picture, China holds about 9% of our public debt. You know, Japan holds about as much. You know, actually, domestic interests hold most of our debt. And so the idea that China is our banker is a fallacious one. They're one of many bankers. But the reality is also that it's not like we're forcing China to buy our debt, to buy our treasuries. China is buying it because it serves its own interest. That's how China manipulates its own currency. In fact, we don't want China to buy our debt precisely for that reason. And on the other side of the equation, so the U.S. could find other bankers, believe it or not. I mean, we really could. I mean, and there's a lot of folks who still believe that the dollar is a very safe bet, and they're willing to make an investment in treasuries. China does it because they want to. The other side of the equation, China is a very export-based economy, and 30% of its economy is in manufacturing, and its largest and richest market that it sends goods to is the United States. China has no substitute for that. I mean, they can't sell those goods internally. They can't sell it to any other country because other countries have trade regimes that mostly call for balanced trade. And so they have no choice but to try to send their goods to the American market. So when you look at who has the leverage in this relationship, it's actually the United States of America that has the leverage. And this is something that I think most people don't realize. Even our politicians here in our nation's capital. And I wish that if there's a one point I could get across is to both our policymakers and the public, we have the leverage in this relationship. We should not be afraid to use it. And we shouldn't be punitive, but we can certainly use our leverage to make a difference with Chinese policy, but we've been unwilling to do that so far.
Scott, you recently penned an article in the Huffington Post about what's really on the minds of the American people these days. Tell us about what you wrote.
Well, I was talking about jobs, and it is the stunning thing to me, and I travel a lot to the Midwest and to other places, is that when you ask the American people what's really on their mind right now, it's the economy, it's jobs. Do people care about our debt, our public debt? Yes, they do. I mean, they there's no question they care about that. But every poll shows, and folks that I talk to out and about in America say the same thing. We got to get our economy back on track. We need to create good-paying jobs. We're not doing a good job. I mean, we did create 244,000 jobs last month, but the vast majority of those jobs were in very, very low-paying occupations. I mean, McDonald's created 62,000 jobs. They had 1 million applications for those jobs. And I'm not demeaning the work that people at McDonald's do, but that's not the type of job that's going to create a sustainable future for a family for a community or for our nation. And our the idea of having a job strategy has just kind of disappeared. I mean, it seems to be gone and to have vanished from the debate in Washington, D.C. And obviously, Republicans in Capitol Hill are talking about cut spending, but also cutting taxes, which is not how you reduce the deficit. That's another matter. But, you know, the administration, to some extent, has fallen to this trap, too. And instead of saying, I'll see your deficit strategy with our job strategy, and then let's meet somewhere in between, you know, they're starting on the Republicans' playing field. And I think that's a huge political mistake, and I don't think that it represents where the American people are on this issue. And I do think unbelievably, the place where the jobs debate may be driven is by some of these Republican presidential candidates, because they're going to be out there talking to voters every day, and they're going to discover that, voters care about debt. The crazy ones are still focused on other issues, but the mainstream voters care about our economy, jobs, children's future, and there's literally no discussion of that in this town. And it is like, I fully expect that out of the Republicans, because they believe they have a mandate to shrink the size of government. But I'm a little disappointed that the administration and others haven't been more forceful in pushing back and saying, no, what we've got to talk about is jobs.
So you're going beyond pure numbers and focusing more on the types of jobs that we need to be creating to get this economy going again. And my question for you is, how do we do that? How do we create those jobs that are good paying jobs that people can work in for decades?
Yeah, and that's the right question to ask. How do we have a sustainable economy? And I think we have to have a diverse economy. I think that we've had a bubble-driven economy for the last generation, and the bubble shifted from the tech sector to housing. And we've seen our experience with that, and it's been a disaster both times. And what's been left behind in a lot of ways is manufacturing and making things. And you're starting to see more of a conversation about this, and part of it is because we've tried everything else, and it hasn't worked. And so let's return to something that we have always been able to do as a country, which is make great products, and that means manufacturing. And so there is we're at the cusp of a important discussion about having a manufacturing strategy in this country, which is something that we don't have. And every other country we compete with around the world has such a strategy on how to make things in their country. We've been pretty unique in the idea that it really doesn't matter. But I think that the time is right. In part because we've exhausted all the other options, and also because people see the logic of this idea that we have to make things to be a great country, to be a strong country, not only for our national security, for our economic security, but also for the creating good jobs on into the future. We have to give young people more options than simply going into a healthcare, a retail, or a service career. If they want the opportunity to make things with their hands, as well as with their minds, they should have the opportunity to do that.
Earlier, Scott, I heard you touch a little bit on the tax issue. How do taxes and tax revenue or tax cuts tie into America's manufacturing sector?
I'm going to talk about two different things here. And one is that most people don't realize, I think, that people realize we've lost manufacturing jobs. They've seen that all around it. We've lost one in every three manufacturing jobs. Taking it a step further, that's a lost job. That affects a worker. It affects his or her family. The factory closes down. What does that mean for the community? It actually means lower tax revenue, more of a demand on public services. It also means that nationally. And if you crunch the numbers, the stunning thing is that we would have close to a balanced budget right now if we only held our share of manufacturing jobs over the last decade. we wouldn't have to do a thing. And state budgets, same thing. I mean, we wouldn't have to go through this painful process where some are scapegoating public sector employees as being the cause of all the budget deficits, which they're not. But our job would be a lot simpler if we had focused on keeping manufacturing jobs in the United States of America. And we can keep them here, and we can do things well. We're a highly productive workforce. We're innovative. We're entrepreneurial. We have the ability to do this if we have the opportunity. And that actually involves some changes to the tax code, which is the other piece of this. And I strongly believe that if we're going to have a tax discussion in this country, it has to be focused on letting workers and businesses who are actually making things in America, giving them a tax incentive to do that instead of shipping those jobs overseas. And unfortunately, they face the exact opposite situation right now, and it's something that serves as a disincentive to create manufacturing jobs in this country.
Scott, my final question for you is, would a reinvestment in infrastructure, a renewed commitment to upping our infrastructure, would that help in this situation?
Oh, absolutely it would. Infrastructure is important, and I mean not only roads and bridges and things like that, but our ports, a smart electrical grid, and other important features, high-speed rail. It would be, it's great for people who are sitting in traffic or have to drive over lousy bridges. It's obviously good for the construction industry where the unemployment rate is 17 to 18%. It creates demand for manufactured goods, and that's obviously a good thing for the manufacturing sector if there's a Buy America requirement attached to it. But overall, it's generally good for the American economy because it makes it easier for goods to get from point A to point B. It makes it much more efficient, and that only helps our economy. It's a smart investment, and this is actually something that, you know, business and labor agree on. You know, they want a robust investment in infrastructure. But again, you know, this Congress, not a peep. I mean, there appears to be no movement towards doing this whatsoever. And our bridges aren't going to get better by themselves. Our roads aren't going to get better by themselves. Our smart grid isn't going to get built by itself. I mean, we need to make that investment, and it's very short-sighted to avoid making that tough decision right now.
Scott Paul, Executive Director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, as always, thanks for your time.
Jason, really appreciate it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss Police Week with AFGE Local 2281 Second Vice President Barbara Heckman-Sauer.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Barbara Heckman-Sauer, Second Vice President of AFGE Local 2281 out in Kerrville, Texas. Barbara, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Now, next week starts National Police Week. Tell us a little bit about the week.
A National Police Week is when we come together in D.C. to honor those officers that have been killed in the past year and the years before that, and to honor those that are serving in law enforcement as well at this time. But we're putting 317 names on the wall, and Friday night at the candlelight, they'll all be read, and a lot of the families will be there, especially the 164 from the past year.
Now, you said 317 names are going to be put on the wall. Which wall is that?
That's the National Law Enforcement Wall at Judiciary Square in Washington.
Is that something that's open to the public? Can anyone come and participate and watch the event?
Yes, it is open to the public. It's at 8 o'clock on Friday evening. And due to the construction in that area, of course, it's going to be a little congested, but we always manage to get a good crowd in there.
You've been involved in this for quite some time. I know you've done a lot to keep the events going forward. Talk about what this week means to you personally.
Well, this week, to me, is my way of connecting with all my families, making sure my families know that their husband or their wife or their son or their daughter's name will never be forgotten. They're together with 19,000 plus other names on that wall. And it's a place where we can all come to. We can all stop anytime along our way and say hello to them and thank them for the job they did, even though they're not with us anymore.
This sounds almost like old home week for you, something that you've been at quite a while. It sounds like you've made a lot of connections, and you speak of families, and it almost sounds like you're talking about them as if they are your family.
Many of them are. We've seen them. They bring mementos that they put on the wall beside their husband or their father's name. Many of them we've seen grow up. We've seen the grade school pictures. We've seen the middle school soccer pictures, the prom pictures, and even the wedding pictures. And so they're always a part of that member's, that police officer's family, even though they're not here anymore.
What other events will be taking place during Police Week this year?
Well, we have an Honor Guard competition, which will be taking place on Saturday. I believe it's at the First Street Park up near the Capitol. We have the Emerald Society March, which will be coming down from around First Street and coming up to the Memorial with all of our Irish pipe bands and the music and the celebration with that. We have, I believe, a 5K run. And then we have the ceremony on Capitol Hill on Sunday at 11 o'clock where various members of the government will be joining us. Sometimes it's the Attorney General, sometimes the President, but other members will be there and will be honoring those people that have lost their lives again.
Now, speaking of law enforcement, federal law enforcement officers, which you are one in the Veterans Administration, face an uphill battle on a number of issues that I don't think people know about. Can you talk a little bit about some of those things that you're facing these days?
We do. The federal officers are in a job series called the 0083 series. Now, when that series was created, OPM decided to pick and choose who got a 6C retirement or 20 years and out. Unfortunately, there's about 20 agencies or so that don't come under that. And Veterans Administration, Department of Defense, police officers are all part of that. Our officers only get their benefits when they die, and this is a bad situation for our officers. They don't have the retirement benefits that Capitol Police, Park Police, and Rangers, Border Patrol have.
And is this part of the issue in the House, H.R. 324, to grant some broader authorities to police officers?
Well, 324 is more dealing with Department of Defense for their arrest procedures. There seems to be a question with Department of Defense as to whether their federal police officers have the right to arrest or apprehend. There's a word game being played.
And when you speak of word games, that seems like that's a big part of this. You all do very meaningful and dangerous work, all pretty much the same thing, it sounds like, as we go around and talk to federal police officers. Why is there such a word game here?
There's a word game because they also put into it a percentage of how much you do investigation and arrests. Not all jobs require arrests and apprehension. In the Veterans Affairs, we're working with veterans that are coming back with problems because they went to war and because they fought to defend what we have. They're coming back with TBIs, concussions. They don't understand why their behavior has changed because they came back and they're getting into difficulties. We don't want to arrest those guys. We want to get them help.
And how do you go about doing that? That seems like a very tricky and tough spot there. You want to make sure that people who are coming home from serving the country are taken care of, not arrested.
Right. We try and do it by using verbal means, by using a community policing approach where we're working with those veterans. It's only when the disruptions occur that maybe we might have to make an arrest. But we try and do it in a way that we can get the medical team involved and get them the help they need.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we've been joined by Barbara Heckman-Sauer, Second Vice President of AFGE Local 2281 in Kerrville, Texas. Barbara, we've learned of some key issues that you're dealing with as a official in your local, one of which has to do with the downgrading of employees and their status.
Yes, they're trying to downgrade our employees. This is out in our what we call the VISN 17, our section in Texas, and they're downgrading our guys and telling them that they don't do the job that they're required at the 7 that we currently have. And this would cut our pay, some of us, up to the tune of about $4,000 a year. And yet we're supposed to do so much more. We're decon certified. We're getting mental health training as mental health officers. And we have so much more to do since 9/11 that it just doesn't make any sense.
So you're being asked to do more, yet federal employees are already under a two-year pay freeze, with many in Capitol Hill calling for an even longer pay freeze, yet you're not getting any more money, obviously, but being asked to take a pay cut.
Right.
How does that make sense?
It doesn't make sense. And twice in the past 20 years, there's been a congressional order to OPM to get the law enforcement pay and their position descriptions tightened up, once in the early 1990s, and then again in about 2004 when Ms. Coles had her hearing on Capitol Hill for job descriptions and pay requirements for federal law enforcement officers, and nothing has still been done.
Why the delay?
I think it's the money issue. Putting the federal officers at the VA would entitle putting money into that federal fund to get it started. And right now, with the budget the way it is, with all the money being spent on veterans care, of course, the veterans are the ones we have to look at first. And so that's where the money is going to go. It's not going to go to keeping them safe and their families safe at the facility.
Last week here on Inside Government, we had on J. David Cox, National Secretary Treasurer of AFGE, 8th District National Vice President Jane Nygaard, and Marilyn Park, Legislative Representative, celebrating Nurses Week. And we learned a lot about what VA nurses are going through right now. And one of the things that seems to be an overlap between the police officers and the nurses is the implementation, or lack thereof, really, of the caregiver law. Could you share some of that with us?
Yes. The caregiver law was enacted, but unfortunately for the veterans police, there has been nothing done about it because the policy has not been written. Until the policy is written, we can't do any of the activities that the caregiver gave us, the increased investigative ability and the increased activity around our facilities. We can't do any of it until it comes through. And then they also enacted uniform allowance, a better uniform allowance, because we were getting $7.62 every 2 weeks to pay for keeping our uniforms up, when our uniforms cost on an average $50 for a shirt and $50 for a pair of pants. So it is not coming anywhere near what we needed to keep our uniforms up and look presentable and professional when we do our jobs.
So there again, it's you're under a pay freeze. You're not getting the money that you were expecting. You're being asked to do more with less. You're being told that you're going to be downgraded. And the subsidy that you're getting to pay for work expenses is next to nothing.
Yes.
How do people in your local react to that?
They're not happy about it. We've been fighting it ever since we heard about the downgrade and we got the information. The information has been consistently inconsistent, with headquarters in Washington Central Office here telling us one thing, our local office telling us another thing, and nobody agreeing on anything.
As a frontline VA police officer, you see and hear a lot, we imagine. When you're going about your day-to-day responsibilities, how do you see things like PTSD or traumatic brain injury impacting those who are being cared for at the VA?
Well, with our guys coming back, not only our Iraqi and Afghanistan vets, but our Vietnam vets, I see the PTSD and what it's done to them. I'm married to a veteran with PTSD and major depression, so I know and understand the fight he goes through every day just to get through the day without getting angry at somebody or blowing off. And we're seeing that with these guys that come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. The problem is they don't know they even got an injury from a head injury in a tank or just seeing something on the field. They don't realize that the trauma caused what's going on with them now.
Are you finding that people are realizing that you don't have to have taken a bullet or been hit physically to have received an injury in combat?
No, I think a lot of people still have that idea that if you're not missing a leg or you don't have shrapnel wounds or you don't have something else that's visible, that it's not there. I've actually had one person who sat on the military appeals board tell me that PTSD is a made-up thing to get money from the government. And if this man is on the military appeals board for compensation, I'm worried about what we've missed.
Explain to the audience a little bit from your experiences how the environment of being in a war in a combat zone can take such a toll on a soldier.
Well, these guys are going over there, and a lot of our guys are the younger guys coming out, and they're going over there and they're seeing, you know, these children being used as weapons, bombs strapped to them and stuff like that. They're never knowing where the next shot is going to come from. And they're seeing their buddies die in front of them. And then they're going back over there, the ones that survive, they're going back there 2, 3, 4, 5 times in a 6 or 8 year period, something that didn't happen years ago. There was a long period of time before you got sent back into a zone like that. That's not happening now because we don't have the manpower to do that.
Barbara Heckman-Sauer, Second Vice President, AFGE Local 2281. Barbara, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund's 25th anniversary with Director of Field Operations, Robin Kehoe.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government, but listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Robin Kehoe, Director of Field Operations for the Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund. Robin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So FEA is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. Tell us a little bit about the organization.
We are so excited to be celebrating 25 years. We exist to help civilian, federal, and postal employees. We're modeled after the military relief agencies that help folks in uniform. But again, we help on the civilian side of government. And we've been doing that for 25 years, and we hope to be continuing to do it for 125 more. We have a couple of main programs that help feds, and the biggest one of those is our emergency assistance program that provides no interest loans for temporary financial emergencies that feds find themselves in. And it also provides grants when there are natural disasters like the tornadoes and storms that have affected the South over the last few weeks.
I imagine then that you all are pretty busy with those natural disasters that we've been facing in the South, the tornadoes, the flooding. Have you seen people coming to you asking for assistance, needing your help?
At this point, we are getting information mostly from managers and other folks on the ground in those areas, letting us know that they are aware of employees who have lost their homes, lost their cars, had severe damage to their property. And we expect that we will begin to get more applications in as people sort through what their insurance is going to provide for them, what FEMA might do to help. They're really just still digging out, I think.
Take us through that application process. How do you get connected, and how do people come about getting the assistance that they need?
We work through the organizations on our board of directors, which are the large federal unions like AFGE, as well as some managers associations. We put the word out through them. We put the word out on our website, www.feea.org. And folks can go to the website. They can click on Get Help Now and be taken to a page that explains the program and contains the application that they'd need. It's a fairly simple application. They fill it out, provide a little bit of supporting documentation, and either mail or fax it into us. And once we have it, as long as it's complete, it usually takes us no more than 2 or 3 days to turn it around for them.
And how about federal employees who may not be victims of a natural disaster or something that's come up unexpectedly, but other hardships? Is there assistance available for them as well?
There is. In those cases, we do no-interest loans. Those are paid back through payroll allotment. They're up to $1,000 at a time. Again, no interest added. And we pay creditors directly. So if folks are having trouble paying for their rent or mortgage, their utilities, those types of basic living needs, we are here to help with that as well. We did almost $500,000 worth of loans in our most recent fiscal year. It's doubled over the last 3 years. Feds are affected by the economy just as much as everyone else.
$500,000 is quite a bit of money. Talk about the impact that has on the life of a federal employee who may be struggling to make ends meet or have some unusual circumstances.
Sure. Again, you know, most of these federal employees are hardworking folks who are struggling sometimes to make ends meet. And if you're sitting at work and you're concerned that the lights are going to be turned off when your kid gets home from work, it really might just be a matter of a couple of $100 that you need to help get you over a rough spot. And when we help folks, we consistently get emails and letters and phone calls saying that it gave them the breathing room they needed to get back on their feet, to focus on their jobs, and to continue working for the country.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking to Robin Keough, Director of Field Operations for the Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund. Robin, you also have another program available that's quite valuable, and that's a scholarship program.
It is. We run an annual college scholarship contest that gives away between $400,000 and $500,000 in scholarships to federal employees and their immediate family members every year. It's a merit-based contest. So we're looking at grades, community service. We're looking for good students, good members of the community, but we're not looking at family finances because we know so many federal employees are in that great middle class where they make too much to get need-based aid, but not enough to really pay for college.
That must be quite valuable, and I imagine that the demand for that is quite high, and I'm sure the competition is high as well.
It is. It's very competitive. We get between 3,000 and 4,000 applications each year, and we give between 400 and 500 scholarships. So it is a very competitive program, but it's very meaningful, and we're trying every year to expand it to have more money to give out, either to increase the value of each scholarship or to increase the number of students who are awarded scholarships.
And you brought up a great point in your description about how people may not qualify simply because they're not at, say, the poverty level. They make enough money to take care of themselves and their families. But sending a child to college when tuition is rising at a very fast rate it must be tough sometimes.
It is very difficult. You know, we've watched college costs rise over the last few years to the point where some state universities, it's now $30,000 or $40,000 a year to send a kid to school. And with all of the other cuts that are happening across government, across different programs for higher education, it becomes harder and harder to finance an education without going deeply into debt.
So you have emergency assistance, you have grants, you have a scholarship program. How about some longer range programs?
We have two very long range programs, which were unfortunately started because of terrible tragedies. After the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995, FIA was on the ground. We were helping federal employee families in the immediate aftermath, folks who lost family members in that bombing. And the outpouring of support was enormous. And so what we did was to create a scholarship program that is an endowed program. It is providing money to send over 200 students who lost a family member through college. It gives them full tuition, room, board, books, fees, whatever they need to get through college. And that program will go on until the youngest child, who was actually born 6 months after the bombing, until that child has had a chance to go through college. We have a similar program for families who lost someone in the Pentagon on 9/11. And that program has about 70 students who will ultimately benefit.
Again, a great opportunity for a young person starting his or her life.
Absolutely. And what we feel about those two programs is that these are individuals who gave their lives in service to their country. And if we can take away one bit of worry that that family might have moving forward, trying to figure out how to pay for a college education, then that's something that we can do to honor the memory of those individuals.
What have you found to be your biggest challenge in your position of helping federal employees?
Our biggest challenge is honestly that so many federal employees still don't know that we exist. We've been around, again, we're celebrating 25 years of serving feds. We've provided in that time over $10 million in scholarships and almost $8 million in emergency assistance. And yet every time I go out to talk to groups of federal employees, I hear people say, well, I've been in the government for 30 years and I've never heard of you. So it's so important to us that when people hear about us, they share that information and pass it on to the next person who might need our help one day.
And again, for those listening right now and want to learn more about you, how can they find more?
The best way is to go to our website. It's www.feea.org.
Robin, we were talking at the beginning about celebrating 25 years. What are some things that you all will be doing during this celebration?
We are going to kick off our celebration at the beginning of June. We will be doing weekly communications to folks who join our newsletter list, which they can do right from the homepage of our website. We'll be talking about the things that we've done over the last 25 years and some of the things that we hope to do in the future. We're also going to be honoring a couple of members of Congress, hopefully, who were instrumental in the early years of FIA, helping us get on our feet and launch the programs. And we also have some members of our board who are founding members and continue to be actively involved to this day. And we'll be honoring them as well.
Are you finding that members of Congress that you're working with, it's a bipartisan effort to commit to these programs?
It is. It absolutely is. We have had support over the years. And, you know, one of the great things is in terms of bipartisan support, even on our board of directors, you know, we have management associations and unions who come to the table, who sit down together and work on programs that do what's best for federal employees. So even though they may have their differences about other things in the workplace, they put those aside when they come together for FIA.
Robin Keough, Director of Field Operations for the Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund. Robin, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you to our guest this week, Alliance for American Manufacturing Executive Director Scott Paul, AFGE Local 2281 Second Vice President Barbara Heckman-Sauer, and Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund Director of Field Operations Robin Keough. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and